From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Author, rock historian, journalist, and critic Ben Fong Torres is my guest. He was one of the original contributors to Rolling Stone magazine and conducted many of the magazine's greatest interviews. Ben Fong Torres' new book is Willin', The Story of Little Feet. Ben Fong Torres, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, Gary. Hi. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, I would guess that interviewing Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan, that can't hold a candle to the thrill you must be feeling right now talking to me. Am I right?
Not at all. And, you know, I like Santa Cruz a lot. I wish I could be there more often. So I kind of envy you your job. Hey, let's trade jobs.
Okay. I'll interview Bob Dylan.
All right. Sure. No, well, there are easier things to do than to do that, that's for sure. Woo!
Well, now, what was it like to interview Bob Dylan? Let's just start with that.
Well, it was an adventure because back in those days...
What year was that that you spoke with Dylan?
Oh, God, 1976.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, I think it was. And back in those days, you didn't have the kind of a coordination and cooperation between a publication or a medium and the artist. And Rolling Stone had a good relationship with Dylan and his people, but not the best, especially after we had run a story, kind of grousing about the prices of the concert tickets on his tour. This is 1974, I'm pretty sure now, think about it.
Oh, yeah, anyway. Those tickets were like $12 or something.
Oh, man. The brutality. Anyway, yeah, so they were not too happy, and so when I said I'd like to come on tour and do an interview with him, they said, well, you can come on tour, and we'll set you up, we'll let you know what hotel we're at, and like that, and we'll give you tickets to the concert, and we'll set up Annie for the photographs, Annie Leibovitz, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of getting Dylan for an interview, you're kind of on your own on that, so good luck. So I had to figure out how to find him and sit down with him, and so I maneuvered my way into a post-concert party. One evening, that might have been in Philadelphia or somewhere where the tour started, and ran into him, and he was nice enough to sit down and talk for a moment, and he had a bad cold, and so I gave him a couple more days, and he said, yeah, we can meet in like Montreal or Quebec, and so we did, and it worked out just fine, as it turned out, but the big surprise was that as we sat down to talk, he looked at my a cassette recorder and said, hey, no recording, because he had been going through a lot of bootleg stuff people going through his trash cans and selling everything Dylan related, and so he didn't want to have any of that, even though he trusted me and Rolling Stone. He just didn't want the possibility of a recording of him doing the interview to get to the wrong hands. And so suddenly I had to switch to notebook configuration, and that was not easy with a guy who was as mysterious and elliptical and puzzling in many ways as Dylan. And so I had no choice but to just whip out the notebook and start writing things down. And that kind of forces you to lose eye contact, and I pride myself in interviews on being able to make it conversational and to have logical follow-up questions. But when you're furiously writing down every word he says or summarizing his comments in a writing that you will understand later, it's hard to carry on a conventional conversation. And so that was a tremendous challenge, and I'm very lucky that it worked out okay, that the article turned out all right. He seemed to be all right with it afterwards, because I saw him not long after the thing appeared, and he was he indicated that it was accurate. So overall, it worked out all right, but it was not easy.
Do you think he was trying to put you off your game by doing that to you?
No, I don't think so. I think he really was paranoid about all the stuff that was happening around him at that time, between the bootleg albums and the A.J. Weberman's going through his trash cans.
Right.
And selling notes and shopping lists and receipts, and God, how would you like that?
You can see how it would turn a guy into a recluse if they do that to
him. Yeah. So So I kind of understood and just kind of, you have to deal with it when it happens. And so that's just one of those adventures on the road.
There's some pictures on your website of you hanging out with Paul McCartney. What was that like?
Well, he is kind of the opposite of a Bob Dylan in that he is totally media savvy and into promotion of himself and his band and the product or the event in whatever way he can. And he is doing that at this very moment,
right?
Witness his media appearances and concerts and his energy. And so that has always been his way, and it's very similar to Mick Jagger. They know how to TCB. And so Paul was always just incredible in terms of interviews on any medium, and he knew the differences in the media and what the various people would want from him, and even the factions of the media. He knew that Rolling Stone was different from Esquire and was different from Time or Life, and he would adjust accordingly. And so he was a pleasure to work with, even though you knew that he knew the game. He gave you what you wanted, and he gave you access to other folks, the other band members or record label people, or you know, whoever you wanted to talk to that he could help you to get, he would do for you. So that was my experience with him. And when I watch him on interviews today, I think he is exactly the same guy, and more power to him.
Were you one of the founding members of the Rolling Stone magazine staff?
Well, no. No, I found Rolling Stone like a reader, like so many other folks around San Francisco, the Bay Area, and then whoever else got to see the magazine early on. And I was just a fan. I was just a reader. But because I was also a tremendous music fan and had been in journalism from college, or high school actually, but also in college and became the editor of the paper at San Francisco State University, where a lot of the rock scene unfolded, it was natural for me to offer myself to Rolling Stone, because by then I had already met a number of the bands. We had hosted blues and folk festivals on campus, which always hyphenated with rock in the mid-60s. And Bill Graham and Chet Helms of the Avalon would come on campus just to, it's hard to believe, they would come up onto the campus to staple concert posters onto bulletin boards around the school to publicize concerts at the Fillmore and the Avalon. And then the rock band, you know, the Janis Joplin, one of her first rehearsals with Big Brother when she joined them out of Port Arthur, Texas, was on the campus of SF State. An unscheduled, probably unauthorized performance, such as it was, in a little art gallery on the campus. And they just set up their PA system and rocked out until someone stopped them. And I was walking by and heard them and found out it was Big Brother and the Holding Company. And then also around that same year, you know, 66, 65, a band called The Great Society showed up and performed a free lunchtime concert in front of our gym. And they were, of course, Grace Slick and her band before she joined Jefferson Airplane. And so later on, Jefferson Airplane were booked with Grace Slick to be sort of, they were the headliners of a kind of an alternative homecoming ball at SF State. And so we had our own little Fillmore scene going on campus at certain times. And so I was part of that and reporting it and writing about it. And so when Rolling Stone came along, it was really a pretty easy transition to offer myself to the newspaper at the time, not a magazine yet. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I was able to do well enough in my first couple of stories to be hired by 1969 for a full-time gig. But they started in late 67, and I didn't glom onto it in terms of writing for it until spring of 68. So it took me a full 5 months to get with it.
We're talking with Ben Fong Torres. His latest book is a history of the band Little Feat, and it's called Willin. In those days, in the 70s, did you know Lowell George?
Oh, no. Unfortunately, I did not. Little Feat was primarily a Los Angeles band, and in the 70s we had a full L.A. bureau that covered the artists there or out of there. And so we had stories about Little Feat, but from our folks in Los Angeles. And by the time he passed away, Rolling Stone had moved to New York City, and I had a different kind of a job with them, kind of West Coast correspondent. I was a fan of Little Feat by way of my DJ show on the radio.
You were on KSAN,
KSAN, yeah, kind of a pioneer, free-form, progressive rock station. And so we all loved Little Feat. There were certain cities like Washington and Baltimore and Boston and L.A. and a few others that had a liking for the band and their adventurousness. And KSAN was definitely one of those bands. And we programmed our own shows. We never had a list of music to play, but it seemed like all of us on a regular basis would play Little Feat.
Now, and you've also written about the Eagles and Gram Parsons recently, a couple of books. Do you still listen to music, go to shows, new music, or do you feel now it's another era for you?
Yeah, I'm too old to enjoy music now. I go back to Henry Mancini and Glenn Yarbrough and Johnny Mathis. Those are my go-to guys. Especially Johnny Mathis.
Yeah,
oh, chances are. No, because I write the radio, well, not only, I love music still. Always have, never will stop. And because I write this radio column in the Chronicle here in San Francisco, I find myself twiddling the dial on a regular basis in the car at home and checking out the newest music as well as different genres of music and then going online to dig deeper with satellite radio and online radio, streaming radio from New Orleans and from Martha's Vineyard and from Woodstock, from Seattle, from EXP up there, and up in the wine country. So I do, in fact, explore and listen to and appreciate pretty much all the music. You know, there are times as an old guy that I don't quite understand some of the newer music, and it's easy to characterize a lot of the pop music, whether it's today or in the 80s, as being so similar. They all sound the same. Who needs more boy bands? Or who needs more of these dancing machines and like that? But, you know, just the other night, watching SNL, I was watching One Direction and thought, wow, okay. So, yeah, the little girls love them. But that doesn't mean necessarily that you should dismiss them, because when you just zoom in on the music and on their performance and on their stage demeanors, you can hear that they are music lovers and appreciators of the roots of good music and harmonies and melodies and messages, and they came off, to me anyway, quite well. And so I'm going to join my grandnieces this Christmas. And
go see it.
We're going to put together our 1D scrapbooks.
Oh.
I love Liam. Woo!
Well, you know, little girls like the Beatles, but that didn't mean they weren't great.
Right, exactly. So
although, do you think in 50 years they'll be celebrating the One Direction? Are they here to stay? Or?
Well, I would not yet put them in league with the standard bearers, the Dylans, the Stones, the Who, and the Beatles, and a few others.
Yeah.
But no, who knows what will stand the test of time. We know that the ones I just mentioned have withstood just about 50 years, remarkably. And there are some that we know of from the 70s and 80s that we think are going to last it. But the ones that have just come along in the last few years, it's always too early to tell. It would have to be someone really remarkable and smashing barriers and drawing a tremendous amount of attention and adulation to say, well, maybe in a couple of decades they'll still remember that person. And there's no such person right now.
Well, Ben Fong-Torres, in your new book, Willin, The Story of Little Feat, I was really taken nostalgically thinking about Warner Brothers Records and that kind of golden era in which they would allow artists to make one or two or three poorly selling records and let them nurture their talent. And, you know, things are so much different now in the music industry. Technology has certainly played a role. Do you think things are better or worse?
It's hard to say. You know, that was Warner Brothers. And really only I really cannot think of another major label that had that kind of a lost leader mentality of saying, hey, well, okay, so Kevin Beefheart and Arlo Guthrie and the Mothers aren't going to sell us a lot of albums, but hey, they're so special and interesting that they give our brand, well, they didn't call it brand then, but our record company a certain kind of an image. And so it worked for them at that time, but we're talking about the 60s. Now, there are hardly any real major labels left. They're all major conglomerates. And so it's a whole new way of exposing music on the part of the artist and discovering music on the part of the fans. And so the old model is long gone, and there is no such thing as a company putting a stable of interesting, revolutionary, quirky artists together to draw attention to the label. Now it's really pretty much artists themselves having to figure out a way to draw attention to themselves, and of course primarily through YouTube and a few other online sites that we don't know about yet. You know, they're constantly reinventing themselves, and there are new things emerging every year. And so there'll be something brand new within the next 2 or 3 years that we don't know about right now that will help to expose music. But yeah, the days of labels and even of exposure in nightclubs, that was the way for a good number of years. Mm-hmm. That between radio and nightclub noise, you would find interesting new artists. And even that now, it seems to have gone the way of the gramophone.
Yeah, well, the technology, Neil Young in his book, you know, he's really, and in his last album, he's really strongly opposed to the current music technology. He says people don't like music as much anymore because they can't hear it as great as we used to hear it on our records. You have any take on the technology aspect?
Well, Neil Young and I can't hear it as well anymore because we're nearing 70, that's why. But, I know that the audiophiles, the purists who really love to hear the music as though it were live in their room cannot be satisfied with what goes on today. And even the moderately fanatic about audio quality would be disturbed to understand that the great majority of people, whether they're music fans or not, are having their music delivered through tiny speakers attached to their computers. And that's the way it is. I think, anyway, that most people no longer go to a family room or a living room or a media room and crank up the big speakers and sit there with headsets and devour music that way. That's just no longer the way it is. But that's just a change in the world. It doesn't really mean that there's less of an appreciation for the creativity of music. I find myself still spellbound by great songs and great performances. And whether it's by Coldplay or Shelby Lynn.
Yeah.
The next great band, or just like last night, SNL, I'll probably now check in on One Direction and hear more of their music just because I enjoyed some of the stuff I heard the other night on television. And that was over television. Now I'll hear it over a couple of these Bose computer speakers that are really quite nice. And then, who knows, maybe beyond that I'll get a CD and then listen to it over our stereo system and enjoy it. But it's not like I need to hear it only in that way anymore. And I think a lot of people, young and old, are totally happy with hearing music by artists they enjoy or are curious about over the computer or streaming music sites or whatever.
Or over their phone.
And they can always move on over to a better medium when the time comes for them. And they can go move all the way to the audiophile vinyl discs if they want to, you know, if they're available. And apparently more and more those are being made available now as vinyl makes a comeback.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's making a comeback.
It all comes full circle, ultimately.
In Little Feat, by the way, they were a integrated band. Were they one of the first integrated bands, weren't they?
Not originally. Well, I guess you could say Estrada, being a Latino, mm-hmm. from the. So yes, you could say that. And then when he left, they brought in Sam Clayton on percussion, and Kenny Gradney on bass. And so there you had that. But that was never a major kind of part of their identity, the way, say, the Chambers Brothers or even the Butterfield Blues Band might have been looked at or identified as, or Sly and the Family Stone, probably more popularly, and Jimi Hendrix, you could say that too. But with Little Feat, I don't think that was really a major part of their ID. That was just what happened. They just found these two guys and, from the Delaney and Bonnie Band, and they sound good. All right, you guys are hired. You know, you're on.
Well, in some way, that makes them even more progressive, that they weren't even thinking about race.
Yeah, but the same probably was true with Sly and Jimmy and the others. It was just, hey, you got the chops, let's go. And that's it. And that's how it always should have been. And in Little Feat's case, I thought the addition of those two were pivotal because they ultimately, along with Paul Barrere and a couple of others, shifted the band away from Lowell George having all the power and direction of the band to more of a democracy.
We're talking to Ben Fong Torres, and his newest book is called Willin', The Story of Little Feat. Ben Fong Torres, do you think Little Feat would have had more success if they had done things differently?
Oh, sure. I suppose so, because when you try to dissect why it was that despite the fact that they were critics' favorites and had tremendous fan bases in various pockets of the country and radio, loved them in various markets, especially on the FM side, that they didn't make it. So like Bonnie Raitt would talk about charisma, having the right song at the right time, sounding too quirky, maybe a little too adventuresome. I don't know. I don't buy all of that because there have been a history of bands that have been way out of the mainstream. There are artists who have nothing like the singing voice of Lowell George. There are a lot of artists who have delved into Southern music or mixed jazz and blues influences into their sound. There are a lot of bands that just stood there with no charisma and just sang, played and sang. Thinking about, for example, Creedence Clearwater Revival, all the way to the Eagles, I'm thinking about within the parameters of Little Feat's existence. Mm-hmm. You have these guys standing there in the blue jeans and plaid shirts and just playing guitar, sometimes looking down, singing songs about the bayou or about the South. Why not Little Feat? Who knows? Some people were saying, the record label didn't give them enough support at the right time, but in researching the book, I found that Warner's was pretty much as supportive as they could have been, given the fact that the first album sold only about 10 or 11,000 copies. That is like nothing. It's almost not even a blip on the radar, and yet they supported a second, a third, a fourth album, and promoted tours, and took them to Europe. And so I believe they got a pretty decent amount of support from the record label, so that wasn't it. So you are left kind of puzzled, and you wind up saying, well, you know, some bands get it, and some bands don't, and it's just like it is today. You know, there are artists that you have probably heard and tried to play and expose who are tremendously talented, and it just doesn't fall into place for them for no good reason. And I think ultimately that's the story of Little Feat.
Well, Ben Fong Torres, your book, it's called Willin, The Story of Little Feat. You've also written recently, the last few years, of books about the Eagles and Graham Parsons. What are you going to write next?
I don't know right now. You know, my agent is always flogging me with ideas.
Yeah.
And that's how it usually works. I'm a pretty passive guy. I'm busy enough in all media to not be out there looking for work. And so when Sarah Lazen says, do this book, then I will, you know, I'll perk up and consider it, which is how Little Feat came about. A big fan of Little Feat at Da Capo Press said, hey, we need a book on Little Feat. And so he spread the word. She heard it, and she called me, and I said, yeah, I remember them, and I like them, and off we go. So that's probably how another one might happen. I'm not in a hurry for it because I'm busy with a website called or an app called Quello, which streams music, concerts, and documentaries. So I do some stuff for them. I write my radio column. I write for various national magazines. And I'm on TV every year for the Chinese New Year Parade here in San Francisco. And these days I'm also doing the Sunday DJ show on Boss Boss Radio, which is online and through a TuneIn app. So it's streaming as well. And I don't get to play whatever I want, but I get to delete what I don't want. So it's the new form of freeform radio.
You're doing a One Direction special this week?
Yeah, 1D all the way, baby. So I'm juggling stuff already. And a book is a major, major adventure. And so I'm going to be pretty careful about choosing the next one. Although I enjoyed this this particular journey, most as challenging as it was, I enjoyed this one with Little Feat.
Well, I hope you'll find time to come back and chat with us again whenever the next book comes.
I appreciate it, Gary.
Ben Fong Torres, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and we'll come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Ben Fong Torres, his latest book, Willin, The Story of Little Feat. Check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can download the podcasts at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.